The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, to look at the week trending, some of the other stories making the news this week, we have Claire Grady, former editor of the Irish Independent, Ian Power, executive director of SpunOut.ie. And a story that I want to start with, if only because two of my daughters at home have been very exercised by the revelation that a key scene in Game of Thrones' final season, been filmed in Northern Ireland, may have been inadvertently wrecked. By who, Claire?
By a PSNI helicopter, allegedly. Great story emerging during the week. It's a journalist writing for Entertainment Weekly, which is a big gossipy and entertainment newspaper or website in the States. And he was present for filming for 11 weeks in April of last year when this was going on, you know, when they were filming these crucial battle scenes. And at a very crucial part in the whole setting, the battle was over, the snow covered, the blood-soaked snow lying around the place.
But be careful now, we don't give spoilers here, you know.
Well, he's already said this, so I have no idea what goes on in this show. And allegedly what hove into view then was a very noisy PSNI helicopter. So this story, of course, has been picked up. And there was consternation, of course, you know, in the film crew on the ground. And we're not sure how it was fixed up. I presume there was a lot of editing
being done. I'm sure they'd managed to edit it out, won't they?
But, you know, like, dragons aren't real. So if they can actually actually put in dragons and stuff, I'm sure a little helicopter in the distance isn't going to be too much of a problem. No, one of the interesting things about this story is the PSNI says, yeah, all very well, but it wasn't our helicopter. We had no helicopter in the area and they're denying it. But it's a good story anyhow. So it does have that one of those, like there was stories used to go around years ago about, you know, films where somebody would be wearing a watch in a Western or somebody would be wearing some other kind of modern gadget, or you could see telegraph wires and the shooting of Ben-Hur. So I'm wondering, is there a little touch of that in this story here?
And in fairness, I don't think it's giving anything away, Ian, as it suggests that there will be some enormous battle scene in Game of Thrones which may involve lots of blood and characters getting killed, given that key characters get killed all the time in Game of Thrones.
And that seems to be the attraction to Game of Thrones. Yeah, no, I'm not a fan. My husband is obsessed, but I haven't actually seen it myself. But no, yes, from watching it over his shoulder, the amount of people who seem to die by the sword in this TV programme, it wouldn't surprise me to see a snow covered in blood.
I wonder, is this splitting many couples that, you know, one wants to watch obsessively and the other just doesn't get it? I mean, you're supposed to in a couple, aren't you, sort of just watch the same things together and sort of give way on stuff that the other person doesn't like?
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly what irks me most is when you're meant to be watching a series together and someone else speeds ahead. That's for me, unforgivable. So I left him away with this one.
If you were out that night and the other person is left at home...
I mean, Netflix has a very broad catalogue, Matt.
It's the Netflix thing. It's not watching it when it's being transmitted. It's the Netflix thing. And I've heard of a lot of people getting into difficulty where they're at home and they think, one more episode. I won't even mention that I watched. And then, of course, you forget. When you put on Netflix, it'll tee up the last one you watch. So, yeah, I can see that being a potential
problem. I can't count the amount of times I've had to rewatch something and pretend it's the first time I've seen it.
Okay, yes, it's a lot of things have to worry about you, Ian. So, listen, I'm the most stolen or shoplifted item in pharmacies is
fake tan. Yeah, so this is a survey from the Irish Pharmacy Union that has emerged this week that apparently thefts of fake tan are making up half of all stolen items from pharmacies around the country, followed closely by cosmetics and perfume and kind of other high value items. But yeah, apparently fake tan, I wasn't aware, but it can average in price between €24 and up to €45. So you can understand perhaps why people are getting light fingered around it. But
see, and I know you say you don't know how much it costs, but how much, I mean, would you get a full application out of one package, or would you be able to get to use it a second time?
I will have to defer to you, Matt, on that.
Claire?
The difficulty with items like that, I imagine, for a shop like that, is you've got high value items which are very small and very portable, and they go into somebody's handbag quite easily. I mean, it is it is extraordinary that it isn't even the highest value item in the shop. I mean, perfume is smaller bottles, you know, to be more expensive. But there's a serious side to that story. I mean, of course, that is the jump out thing. Like half of all items stolen are that, but it's never behind the counter. It's in the aisles, but there's an awful lot of actual violence and burglaries in chemist shops because of the other things that are stolen quite a lot, and that is, you know, medicines and different drugs that they have behind the counter.
Indeed. Of course, the other thing which is stolen most in supermarkets, I suppose the male equivalent of the fake tan for women, assuming that it's mainly women who use the fake tan, there aren't that many Gavin Hensons around in Ireland, is razor blades.
Oh,
that's
of course,
the big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, now in the last couple of years, you see that they're all security tagged, so you can't, you know, you can't even use the self-scanners anymore for razors because you have to go somewhere to get them detagged. Yeah.
They're put in containers that you actually have to go and get removed before you're able to scan them for yourself. But you wouldn't know that.
I would not know that.
Okay, listener Niall in Tipperary says, Matt, watch things together. What kind of a sham marriage have you got? The whole joy of life is separate TVs. You should try it sometime. Well, I do make a confession that when I come home from my own TV show in the evenings, everyone else is in bed. I do enjoy sort of 1:30 to 1:30 watching something on Netflix, but not in a series that I'm simultaneously watching.
Very good, very good.
Exactly. All right, okay. But actually, speaking of makeup, we did discuss yesterday for Barry, Aer Lingus following the example of Virgin Atlantic in dropping mandatory makeup for female cabin crew. What do you make of that, Claire?
I think it's a really interesting story, and I think most young women seem to wear makeup. They seem to wear an awful lot more makeup than I would have worn in my teens and in my 20s. And I imagine a lot of women will continue to, who work in Aer Lingus and the airlines will continue to wear makeup. But I think actually when you look at it, the idea that it would be mandatory for a person in their job to have to spend X amount of money and X amount of time. I mean, it would not be unusual for somebody to be spending 15 to 20 minutes putting on makeup in the morning. I won't say it takes me that long for the amount I put on. But it, like, it adds to somebody's working day. And the idea that it's mandatory, I think in a few years' time, we'll look back and think, it was what? Mandatory? Because there was a case a couple of years ago, and I think it was in some sort of an office in England, London, I think, where the receptionist had to wear high heels, and she brought a case, and she brought on a health and safety ground that she shouldn't be made to wear high heels. And then you kind of look around, and women are expected in some jobs, especially front of house type jobs, to wear high heels. And I think in times to come, it's going to be looked back and people are thinking, what an odd thing. Why did women put up with that? And the idea that women would be told, in order to go into work and do your job, you have to put on makeup. I mean, where's that coming from? I think it's a great move. It's odd that it took this long, though.
I mean, yeah, it's not before time. I think the interesting thing is that today is International Women's Day, and this seems to be the airline's offering. And I think it's a pretty mild and to be honest, underwhelming offering from airlines that they're doing this, particularly in the case of Virgin Atlantic, because they have now said that they don't have to wear makeup. But if women choose to wear makeup, they have to adhere to a particular palette of lipstick and foundation as set out in their guidelines, which to me is almost kind of defeating the purpose.
Yeah, but Ian, it's also been suggested by listeners yesterday that actually for male staff that there are rules about what type of hair they're able to wear, hairstyles, and also about having a beard. You, for example, probably would be told not to wear your beard.
I'm currently sporting a very dirty beard. Yeah, I mean, I think, to me, to be honest with you, do passengers care? I don't think we do. I think as long as we get served in a timely fashion, as long as we're safe, you know, in the event of an emergency, do we care what the cabin crew look like? I don't think so.
I think it's a massive time lag between when airlines were glamorous and it was all about making the customer feel really special, and there's been a huge time lag between them catching up in their public face, and we know that the cabin crew is there, yes, obviously in the case of emergency, to keep us safe and to get us off the plane safely, but really they're there to sell us stuff, to upsell things, and so it doesn't really matter what you're wearing. You don't mind whether somebody who's on the checkout in the supermarket is wearing makeup or not, and the same thing, you don't mind whether somebody in the cabin crew is wearing makeup.
But also, it could be a tough job. I mean, sometimes you have, like the story we've seen from an Air India flight where there's an Irish lawyer. And we have to be very careful how we say this because I don't want any legal actions arising as a result of this. But it seems that an Irish lawyer who described herself as an international lawyer, human rights lawyer, I think as well, lost it after a few bottles of wine on board in business class.
Spectacularly lost it. You read of things when, you know, when there's a gang of young people and not so young people on a kind of a holiday flight to one of the Costas, you know what I mean, too much drink, you know, consumed at the airport. But this was a lawyer on a 9-hour flight in business class, I want to add, from Mumbai to London last November. And to say she lost it in spectacular fashion is not exaggerating. She had 3 small bottles of wine with her breakfast, which was served soon after takeoff. And then she started demanding more drink. Then she went in and tried to light a cigarette in the bathroom. Then she, when she wasn't getting her own way, when she wasn't being served drink, she actually spat into the face of one of the cabin crew.
And we can say this because she's pleaded guilty at court.
She's pleaded guilty in Uxbridge Magistrates Court.
And
it's so interesting to see what penalty she got, because she pleaded guilty to assault and to being drunk on an aircraft. Now, this was a sustained thing. It was a nine-hour flight, and there was various episodes through this. I mean, the cabin crew were actually in fear for their safety, and they were in fear for the other people's safety. You can imagine somebody going berserk like that, lighting cigarettes.
She said, shouted things like, "I've done so much for you, effing Indians," and obviously it wasn't effing, she said, "and effing Pakistanis, you should be grateful to me."
It was the racist element of it as well. I mean, it's
the C word was used liberally as well.
It will be so interesting, and I am going to watch out for that. One, the magistrate said it was too serious to be sentenced her there, so she's been sent forward to the Crown Court in April. Assault, being drunk in an aircraft, and that sort of behaviour, I would imagine, if it was somebody in the today's equivalent of a tracksuit on a flight to somewhere in Spain who had had a few drinks at Dublin Airport and did a half of that, they'd be getting a jail sentence.
I think there has to be questions as well around, you know, I flew long haul recently back from Kuala Lumpur, and the air cabin crew kind of, I don't know whether they're told to or sometimes, you know, it's in their interest to try to get you a little bit drunk so that you fall asleep for the remainder of the flight so that you're not causing the problems. I don't understand, you know, why someone would be given three bottles of wine in quick succession
for breakfast,
you know, with a flight that's taken off at 4:10 a.m. I also don't get the obsession with having a pint in the airport, no matter how early in the morning.
Alcohol goes to the head at altitude, which is why three small bottles of wine can be enough to knock somebody over.
And this is not to absolve this person of their behaviour. They absolutely have to be held account for what they did. But I just think it's worth considering.
I do think
our practice.
The fact that she was in business class might have had an impact on that. I mean, I'm not saying that, like, if you're in steerage, which is where I am normally covered, I don't remember being plied with drink on any flight I've taken recently. But I imagine in business class, people are expected to be a little bit more civilised.
Some of your last words to 0874 100 102. Sharon says, forget the makeup. It's all about time all cabin crew wear trousers. Surely they would be safer in an emergency situation. Peter says, personal hygiene is more important than makeup. Now, I remember it's about a year ago that we discussed incidents at a teen social at Bandon Rugby Club in Cork, where some teenagers were treated for extreme alcohol intoxication. And medics who we interviewed on the programme set up what was described as a field hospital to treat those affected. They've taken measures that I'm presuming are of interest to you as executive director of spunout.ie, Ian, to try and make it safer for these teens, and they seem to be working. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so the court recommended these changes to the hosting of teenage discos, as you say, last year on foot of those events in Bandon and elsewhere in West Cork. And the judge there, James McNulty, recommended a few different things. So one, that parents be signing up to a parental responsibility commitment, right, which basically is that the parents have to be contactable by mobile phone, that they should be personally involved in the travel arrangements of the child to the disco and from the disco, and that they should accompany the child if there's any issues in terms of the Gardaí or any court
hearings. This is, of course, but the party bus has been so popular for many teens.
Exactly. So it's really interesting because it seems to have worked quite well in that parents are kind of stepping up to the plate rather than just leaving the children off to go to these teen discos on their own. They seem to have a lot more ownership around it.
You're going to have to stop calling them discos. Nobody who's a teen knows what you mean by disco. They call them socials, Ian.
Socials, dances. We go back to the 70s. But it's really interesting, though, that the parents are also giving consent for their child to be breathalyzed. And so what's really interesting is that the judge has kind of cautioned the use of it. It's not to be used in random circumstances, but that it's really interesting because children are individual rights holders as well. So from our perspective, like, absolutely, the parents' consent must be acquired, but also they should get the consent of the child or the young person
for
as well.
If you're under the age of 18, you shouldn't be drinking. Now, we all know
absolutely
that children do, unfortunately, drink. But if they're breaking the law, surely they can't object to being breathalyzed.
Well, I mean, it's not that the breaking of the law is the purchase of alcohol, not necessarily the drinking
consumption of it.
So, I mean, I just think it's a bit nanny state to kind of go in and not ask the child before you breathalyze, and that, you know, to kind of say that children don't have any rights at all, from my perspective.
Claire, what do you think?
I imagine, I know where Ian's coming from. That I imagine the situation where the breathalyzer might be used is if somebody in charge, a responsible adult, says, you are drunk, you have to go home, I'm calling your parents, and the child is saying, I'm not, I haven't been drinking, well then, here's the breathalyzer, prove it to me. And I know they have to prove their innocence, which isn't really fair either. But this has all been done for the protection of the youngsters, you know, of the children, as you call them. So I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think it'll be used kind of just, you know what I mean, picking people out. But if somebody was being told that they had to go home because they were drunk, I imagine in those circumstances, they would be able to clear themselves by blowing into the breathalyzer.
Yeah, I think absolutely. As long as they're given the choice. And look, these recommendations seem to be working really well in terms of these events. And I think a lot of young people would be very sad if these events weren't going ahead. So as long as these are enabling those social occasions to take place.
I do think that judge deserves some credit, Judge James McNulty, because it would have been very easy for a judge to say, sorry, no licenses, you're not getting your dance licenses, you made a show of yourselves the last time out. But this was a very imaginative approach. I mean, young people do need sort of outlets, social outlets, and a very imaginative approach, and seems to be working.
Listeners, just ask socials, will you stop? There's still discos here in Clare. Are they discos to you if you're a parent, but are they called discos by the teenagers?
They used to be called socials before they were called discos in my part of the country. So it's obviously coming back
again.
Which
is Mayo.
Yes, Mayo.
All right, okay. All right, Kylie Jenner. She's not a teenager anymore. She is now what age? 21. She has been described by Forbes magazine as the world's richest self-made woman. Self-made? Isn't she not piggybacking on the fame of her family?
Yeah, so this erupted last July when they first put her on the cover of America's Richest Self-Made Women list. But it flared up again on Tuesday because Forbes officially named her as the youngest ever self-made billionaire, previously beating Mark Zuckerberg, who was 23 when he was given that title. And yeah, a lot of people are questioning the fact of whether or not she really is self-made, given the fact that a lot of people feel like she flew in on the coattails of her sister Kim Kardashian. And obviously, you know, the momager herself, Kris Jenner.
You sound jealous there now.
It's incredible, to be fair, what she has done. Her company is valued at 900 million euros. She's got 100 million euros in the bank, and all from these lip kits that she's been selling over the last few years. So fair play to her for being entrepreneurial
Aer
Lingus enough to do it.
Travel staff.
I mean, there was always like Forbes got drawn into the whole thing about how they define a self-made billionaire. And they do point out that, like, even people who didn't inherit wealth, okay, there's a big distinction. If you inherit wealth and you make more of it, you're not a self-made billionaire. But even people who have being able to leverage their parents' connections, who get an incredibly good education, who are introduced to the right sort of people, they are often called self-made billionaires, even though they've got intangible sort of benefits. And I say Kylie Jenner is in the same bracket.
She got to appear in Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Yes. It's the biggest marketing vehicle you could imagine.
But she got 1 billion herself, so that's okay.
And she could have sat back and done nothing else, you know. I mean, she would have been made for life from her fees from that. Yeah. It's on its like 15th series at the moment. But she chose to set up a business and work hard at it.
Claire,
fair play.
Really important story at the moment is the way that internet has been used, the likes of Facebook in particular, has been used by anti-vax groups, anti-vaccination. There's appalling issues now in relation to measles and mumps in this country, the United States, other countries, as a throwback to the appalling behaviour of the struck-off Dr. Andrew Wakefield. But now it turns out that it seems that Amazon has been, inadvertently or not, helping fund anti-vaccine organisations.
Yeah, I mean, I get the impression that it's probably inadvertent. I mean, it's a scheme they have, this Amazon Smile fundraising program. So Amazon donates 0.5%, so 0.5% of the purchase price of their transactions to an organization of the shopper's choice. So there obviously isn't a huge amount of research or by Amazon into which are the organizations. And it turns out that four prominent anti-vaccine organizations, mostly in America, you know, physicians for informed consent. And that's a very difficult one. Like at a glance, you wouldn't know what that was about. The other one, National Vaccine Information Center, again. So these are all very much anti-vaccine. So Amazon has been maybe unwittingly channeling purchasers' money to these organisations. I don't like calling them charities, but they're not for profits, supposedly. And I mean, we know that the anti-vaccine thing is like, it's been so damaged by social media, by all of this sort of interaction, and it is quite shocking to think that, I mean, if Amazon, their project is funneling money towards them, what other projects are getting money because they don't have a name that sort of says we're the bad guys.
It's fascinating, you know, as well at the moment, the amount of young adults who are now discovering that because their parents mistakenly didn't get them vaccinated, that they're vulnerable to mumps and measles.
And we're seeing massive spikes, particularly since Christmas as well, in some of those diseases coming back. And, you know, unless the herd is fully vaccinated, for want of a better phrase, you know, nobody's kind of protected from that. And I think that's really irresponsible. And we've seen that, you know, particularly with the HPV vaccine, social media spread lots of rumours around that. And it took a lot of effort from the HSC to get rates back up to kind of 65% from kind of 90% plus. So, you know, I think it is worrying that, you know, massive platforms like this are being used to gather momentum and money for these types of movements.
Got to leave it there. Ian Power from spunout.ie and Claire Grady, thank you very much for joining us. Listener says, funny how people forget where the Kardashians actually got their original fame from. I suspect quite a few people remember how Kim emerged on the scene.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.